Hello and welcome to another episode of the Idealized Science Podcast. I'm your co-host, Jacob Becky, and with me as always is Dr. Wargo. How's it going, Wargo?
Hello, nice to see you.
Nice to see you as well. I'm excited for this one. We're covering Learning for Understanding, a report by the National Research Council from 2002. This is a book that I remember you pulling off your shelf when I was in your high school classroom and telling me how great of a read it was back then and having me read parts of it. And I think it's really basically as relevant today as it was then and even as it was when it was published. So I'm really excited to chat about this one.
I am too. And it's something that I think every science teacher should read. They might think, well, 2002 was a while ago. You don't have to worry about that. Everything in this book still is, for the most part, something that you could absolutely gain from reading. So please do.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so we hope to at least give a brief summary right now so that if, you know, people are very pressed for time, they can come away at least with some takeaways. But we hope to encourage people to read it for themselves. It really is super accessible, even for, you know, people that aren't educational researchers. And so, yeah, I will just jump in. And then, you know, after a brief summary, we will circle back with some questions that I have for you that, I, you know, came up as I was reading it. So, yeah, maybe to start, just to give an idea of what this report really is, it was the result of a 2-year effort by the National Research Council that was set out specifically to examine advanced study in mathematics and science courses in U.S. high schools. So the typical and most common one that people that are listening will probably be familiar with is Advanced Placement AP from the College Board. And so really, this was one of the main two types of courses that they were analyzing. And sort of they come out swinging right out of the gate with some sort of, I don't want to say harsh, it is very like calculated and balanced throughout the report, but they start out by saying basically, advanced placement in its current form is not meeting the standards set out that we've talked a little bit about on this podcast and we'll continue to talk more about. But these educational standards that come out in the 90s and keep morphing into different national standards, the committee found that existing programs for advanced study are often inconsistent with the research results on cognition and learning and fail. They come up short of the actual standards that were at the time, 2002, so this would have been whatever the standards were in 2000, they still failed to meet those. And then another huge point that they point out right out of the gate is just the inequity of advanced placement, pointing out that minorities, inner city and rural students face serious limitations in even accessing these programs, let alone finishing them, being encouraged to continue through them. And the one quote that hit this home for me is, "The availability of advanced placement in a school decreases as the percentage of minority or low-income students increases, especially in mathematics and the sciences." So this just, to me, points out, you know, not only is AP not really doing what it set out to do in terms of preparing students with deep conceptual understanding, but then you also have this huge problem of an imbalance in who actually has access to these things. And so when you look at what that does then down the line for how it impacts people's college admissions and all these things, it really becomes a huge problem. So we'll dive into a lot of these topics, but maybe before we start digging into each point with some granularity, maybe you can give the listeners an overview of sort of the findings and recommendations that the committee had based on what the learning research at the time said.
Yeah, when I bought this book, and it was cheap at the time because I got into the game late with this. At the time, I was at university, and I was reading all of the, if you go to the reference section here, you're reading their actual research papers. And so you don't typically read books or anything like this. You go directly to the research. But I remember getting this, I imagine, 2007, 2008. So it had been out for a while. And so if this is 2002, they had been building on all of the research from, you know, we had a cognitive revolution. So before we had behaviorism, cognitive revolution comes along. And then, let's see, I have it right here. How People Learn, right, comes out in 2000, which means they had been using the research from the late 90s and earlier, but just a massive wave was coming. And then this book here, you said they come out swinging, and it's also important for everyone to understand, they're not using academic language that would turn people off. They are concise, and they allow your casual reader to understand exactly what they're saying. And they pull no punches. You know, occasionally they'll use the word inconsistent with current, you know, reform research. And other times, like towards the end, they come directly out and say, you should not be using this. It's pretty amazing. So one of the things I want to point out is, those of you that know me, I always write in my book. So whenever you write in a book, you remember where you were and why you were writing and how you feel about that. So these are the actual things that I wrote right away. But I'm just going to start off with the page two. Page two, they start right away. And they basically say this in page two, AP and IB are inconsistent with cognitive research. Advanced study should be for all. I mean, this is one of the most important points that I think this is really getting at is, you know, we should not just be teaching and targeting students that we think are going to excel. All students matter. And that's a really important point. And then it says why we should not track students. So this is something that we don't talk about anymore. I don't know why. It's still relevant. We track students as if these are going to go into science. These students are not. And these students are never going to understand it. And all the research...
Yeah, to be clear there, you're saying why we shouldn't put students down certain tracks like in middle school mm-hmm. and say, this is an advanced math student and this isn't. And then that sets them up either for,
in high school, it's a mm-hmm. little different because you might say, look, these are going to be students that are going to go out into the trades. So they're not going to need advanced science. And I just don't think that's true. If you're going to be an electrician, if you're going to be a carpenter, you know, you're working with architectures and engineers and things of that nature. So I think that's always been the problem. And, you know, back in the day, they would call it science literacy. We need everyone to be basically literate with science. So this is very important that they say, no, this is for all students. And later on, they literally say, if you have courses that are not challenging your students in science, eliminate them. I mean, this is not some academic jargon. They literally say, and I'll paraphrase what I've written, but other times I'll read directly out of the book, and it says these courses should be eliminated. Remember, we're on page three, okay? Page four, I'm just going to, and you can cut me off whenever you need to. And this is not like, you know, a hardcore, everyone needs to be a scientist. They are talking about social problems impede student thinking in school. They are taking this into account. If you are coming from a background where there are problems or, you know, you're just stressed, that impedes how you're able to think in school. And AP, as you said, is not regularly taken by low SES. So in many ways, we're discriminating and we are perpetuating that if you're in low ES or SES, we're going to have you stay there. And that's not what we should really be doing. The other important point that they talk about right here is the high school college interface. Lack of AP does not adversely influence admission. In other words, if you don't take an AP class, it doesn't mean you're not going to get into that college. And they looked at this rather rigorously, and they found out that oftentimes your scores come in too late. The schools have already decided, so you don't need to worry about that. It gives some history. And now it goes right to it. It says, learning with understanding for deep conceptual knowledge. That's one of the key aspects of what they're getting at. You should be covering major concepts, addressing prior knowledge and beliefs, metacognitive learning. Three, right away. Boom, boom, boom. And remember, we're now on page seven, right? And now we've got a list. What research tells us, and we'll go into this in more depth. It says, go into depth, use inquiry, make sure you're hitting big ideas. Student discourse is vital, and make and argue about claims with data and theory. This is page seven. Let me do one more set of pages, and then I can let you back in here. Formative assessment, all right? Don't just, you know, use one test at the end. It's too late. Oh, you don't understand this. Let's move on. It's too late. Then it says, what does research tell us about AP? In case our viewers are like, look, I only have 10 minutes to listen to this, let me just spill the beans right here. AP is about breath. We just did another whole podcast on this and the problems with this. Insufficient emphasis on key concepts. focuses primarily on procedural knowledge. And they try to teach AP for your first physics course. So there's no chance that you're going to understand this. AP does not appear to help students develop metacognitive skills. The AP exam does not actually even capture student learning. They're saying that right here. Collaboration requires time, which is in short supply because they're trying to cover too much. And students need inquiry, and AP is not providing that, plain and simple. It is not aligned with current teaching research. Too many topics, too quickly, no time for deep conceptual knowledge. They're saying AP is trying to mimic these college courses. And
right.
they scold this right away. They're like, why are you trying to mimic courses? I don't know why people think that if you go to university, you're going to have best practice. You don't. They are forced right. to go quick, and they are weeding students out. And they're saying, whatever you do, do not follow that. That's not going to help.
Right.
High school is the time to really have a course for advanced study where you can push students, get them to learn. They have the time. And they say, there's big payoff. I know that was a lot, and I apologize, but I'll kick it back over to you. But I can keep going.
This is exactly what I think is, you know, if people take nothing else away, they at least have heard sort of the main points of the shortfalls of AP. So no, this is all good. And I think we should dive into a few of the pieces in some more depth. I think the one point that you said that, you know, when I was reading it really stuck out is this idea that just accelerating a course is like making it more like preparing students better for college. So they're just going to take less time with key concepts, and they think that going through more is going to be beneficial for students. And as we talked about in a previous podcast on depth versus breadth, which, you know, we encourage people to listen to if they haven't heard that specifically or if they're interested in learning more. But empirical studies show that that just isn't the case, that covering everything at a surface level is actually not helping the students, and in some cases, it's actually doing harm. And so the fact that the AP setup, and I do want to talk a little bit about the current state of AP, wondering what has changed in the past 20 years, because in their defense, they do point out that the College Board was talking about how they were going to make new iterations of exams that focused more on deep conceptual understanding and cutting and having connections between concepts and exposing students to novel problems, these sorts of things that the committee points out were not present at that time. I will say when I took AP Calculus, and I think they're the softest on calculus in this report, like they say that the committee really found that the AP Calculus exam was actually set up in a pretty solid way. So it's not like they're just berating everything equally. Not all the subjects were at the same point. And so they were just calling basically upon the College Board and other, teachers, administrators, curriculum developers to try and make these advanced courses align better with what what all of the educational research, what all the cognition research sort of indicates
about
how
students
actually learn.
Since you brought that up, let's just dive right into the AP Calculus. And I think you might be able to speak more eloquently on this. I think there's a fundamental difference between how we're teaching science and mathematics. Look, we are begging teachers not to decontextualize science. You know, they're saying you should be using instrumentation right. and things of this nature. I think one of the reasons why they're a little bit more accepting of the calculus is because no one expects it to be contextualized anyhow. For them, they're saying, well, if you can use this in a variety of different problems, you're doing a great job. My criticism of mathematics and how it's taught has primarily been that, is it is so decontextualized. And I see this again and again with students. They're passing tests, but they don't fundamentally understand what any of it means.
Right.
You know, I mean, this happened to me. And when I went to university, thankfully, I had some real reform professors at the time. They didn't realize they were, but they sat me down. And they, like, for instance, they asked me, do this problem in front of me. And they said, okay, what does any of this mean? And I did the calculus in front of them. I was trying to show off. And they said, that's wonderful. I understand that you can do it. What does it mean? And I would,
right.
they said, what's a derivative? And I was like, well, you know, it's, and they're like, let's just start over. So while they are essentially saying calculus kind of gets a pass here, I still am a little bit trepidatious about saying that it could not, you know, improve. I think calculus without some kind of physicality is missing a wonderful opportunity. So I don't know. I figured I'd get your thoughts on this.
Yeah, no, I mean, I definitely agree with you. It's an interesting point that I hadn't considered, because if the committee of mathematicians, mathematical researchers that was interviewing all of the people specifically on the AP Calc exam, if they were, you know, if the standard is, like you said, that it's okay for things to be decontextualized as long as students are exposed to key ideas and have to apply them in novel situations and stuff, you know, then it could be that the committee found less wrong with that because they were just expecting it and they were used to it. But I will say that I think minimally, if the AP physics and biology, chemistry, if they were focused, if the exam actually had a representation of the key ideas that was, because that one of the things they point out is that the exam really did not have at that current time, didn't have the same proportions that you would expect. Like when we talk about what are the key ideas, you know, in a mechanics course, we talk about Newton's laws, we talk about conservation of energy, conservation of momentum, but then there was a disconnect between the actual exam representation of those key ideas and what was, you know, what is encouraged by the standards.
Yeah.
And so I think what they were saying about the calc, you know, exam was just that it did better along those lines. I don't think they were saying it was perfect, and I agree with you that it is fundamentally, but I also don't want to speak too harshly about mathematics education, just because I'm somewhat familiar at this point with a lot of, through talking with you over the past decade, somewhat familiar with the educational research focused on physics. And I've taken, you know, some physics education research, a course at CU Boulder. And so I feel like I can speak a little bit to the state of things. I don't know the state of the mathematics education research and sort of what they're pushing for, but I can say, at least in all of my math classes, I definitely never felt that things were as real or as contextualized as they were in physics courses, even when those physics courses had their shortcomings.
Well,
let me
ask you this question. Did you ever feel that you had a deep, I mean, one of the things they're calling for is deep conceptual knowledge. Do you feel that when we are teaching calculus, we're going for deep conceptual knowledge, or is it really procedural? Oh, I'm going to integrate by parts.
No, it's
why?
Yeah,
well,
it's
looks like
it's absolutely
that, right. And so
it's
that's
absolutely procedural. Yeah. I will say, so the AP calculus teacher that I had was very, she also graded the exam and so knew a lot of what was going to be on there. And so I absolutely taught to the test in a way, which they discourage, of course. That said, you know, she absolutely did a great job of getting us all prepared for the task at hand. Did we go, you know, and explore our other interests that intersect with calculus? Not so much. And so that's definitely lacking, but that's not to say that I think I didn't get a good calculus education. So it's tough because I did feel prepared to move on to, you know, Calc 2 when I got to college and so on and so forth. But yeah, did it ever feel, you know, deeply connected and sort of, just like this, it really still felt like a disparate set of facts that we had to apply in a bunch of different situations and sometimes connect them. Like the notion of the limit, right?
Yeah.
Being pervasive through all of, you know, differentiation, integration, all of calculus, right? So that was something that's what they said was a good thing. But yeah, did we ever really feel that we were going for a deep conceptual understanding? I wouldn't say so. We really were trying to get through the content that was known to be on the test. And I think in math, it's even easier to do that because, like you said, integration by parts, right? You see an integral and there's just only so many things in that Calc 1 sequence or Calc 2, whatever it was, that you could possibly use to solve that integral. And you know, coming into it, that there's only five tools that maybe you can use. And so there's this, I don't know, it did feel a lot more procedural. For some reason, physics seems difficult. And they also point this out, that students, young students, novice students find it difficult to take this collection of facts and know when to use what and what the limitations are. And they often, intro students are often just using their formula sheet as sort of a crutch to find something and maybe try and apply it without really internalizing what the problem's asking or how to approach it. And so I guess I've been rambling a little bit too much here, but I would agree wholeheartedly with you that both math and physics are still have a ton of shortcomings in the standard presentation in high school. But all I was saying was that, at least in my experience and with what the committee found in you know, the 2000s, that calculus was at least a little bit better at that stage.
I want to point out that there's a lot of really good calculus teachers out there, and they are following exactly what their guidelines are essentially telling them. And many teachers are like, look, I'm an AP teacher. That is my goal, is to get you prepared. We know calculus is a gateway.
Totally.
It's super important. My gripe, I think, is that those that are teaching mathematics teachers, if you ask a mathematics teacher, where is this applied in the real world? They're not embarrassed or anything. They'll say, that's not what we do. We're mathematics teachers. And I find that so odd that it's just out of place to even ask that. No. We teach procedure. You're going to teach application. And I often think, no, you're missing. You could, like, by taking that one last step, I think there'd be a synergy that would just allow everyone to go up. So I hope we don't sound like that we're, targeting calculus teachers, because they are vitally important to get students through. Because let's face it, calculus is the gatekeeper. If you want to be an engineer or go into science and you can't pass the calculus class in college, you're stopped. You're not going on. So
I would say that you know, I'm sure I have never interacted with a math teacher that has gone above and beyond in terms of showing any of the students like the real world applications or even like modern math connections and stuff. But that doesn't mean that they aren't out there, and that's why I'm always hesitant to say any, you know, two blanket statements. But my experience in all of my math courses has been pretty much that you learn procedures to solve problems. You check in the back of the book to see that you got those problems correct, mm-hmm. and then you move on until maybe an undergraduate like proofs class. I think like a discrete math or a proofs class, you start to get into this feeling of like, oh, this is like real math, quote unquote, because you're starting to say, okay, here's a theorem, prove it, right? And there might be multiple ways or hundreds of ways when it comes to something like Pythagorean theorem or something to prove it. So that opens up a whole new world, but most students aren't getting to that point. And so they leave with this impression that math is just this extremely procedural, decontextualized thing. And this is what the committee is saying for all these fields we need to get away from. And so maybe to get back a little bit to each of these points, because I had some questions for you, I just want to review. I like the structure, but I want to get your input on how or what the status of this concept that they present, which is the 7 principles of human learning. I find it surprising that you could reduce it to just 7. And I first want to read it for the listeners, just read through them briefly. And then I want to get your input just to contextualize this for us a little bit about how this connects and sort of how complete is this model of human learning. I'll just go 1 through 7. Principled conceptual knowledge. This was saying, you know, focus on large concepts. They point out that experts are not using formula sheets and a bunch of disconnected facts to solve problems. They have key ideas that they pull from, and then they build a whole, you know, web of knowledge based on those key ideas. Prior knowledge, right? Students, their prior knowledge, their background is the starting point for learning. Metacognition is beneficial for learning. I think we should dig into that one in particular. There are differences among learners that have to be taken into account to teach effectively. You can't teach a course and just aim at one type of student. You'll miss everyone else. Motivation is essential. You touched on this a little bit in the intro, but if there are things going on at home or whatever, and students are stressed and distracted or overworked when students have jobs in high school, these all affect motivation and affect learning. Learning communities are essential. Right, you have to foster a learning community that's inclusive in the classroom, that everyone is supporting everyone else's learning. And then learning is situated and it has a context associated with it, and that's deeply important for learning. So yeah, if you could just comment on these and give a picture of you know, how complete this is and maybe what has changed in the time since this report came out. And then maybe we can circle back after that to metacognition, because I really want some more context here.
One thing before we go on with the math, just to make sure that we're putting our math friends at ease, I think we are now challenging ourselves. Let's see if the Idealized Science Institute can start helping with some of these pieces to help contextualize math and see if we can, supplement some of, what they need to do with maybe some things that can make real world connections. So that way we're not just talking the talk. Let's see if we can walk the walk and help a bit. In terms of the seven principles, I think you were, I think this is what you're talking about, box 6-1.
Yeah.
And remember, this is all coming from a consensus document, how people learn. And there's another companion to this. It's how students learn science. And they actually did this for history and mathematics. So there, actually, I think I have, here it is. Here's the one for science, right? And so they didn't just stick to science. They actually went to history, which is fantastic. But look, all students come in and they have misconceptions. As you've often pointed out, there's a difference between preconceptions and misconceptions. But what we need to remember is students come in and they have fully formed models or schemes in their head. It's not like when they say heavier objects fall faster than lighter objects, they don't have anything behind that. They've done experiments. They've dropped a piece of paper and a ball and so on. Our misconceptions, we have to be very careful, because when we add new experiences, that can actually strengthen the misconceptions that they have. So as a teacher, we're like, oh, I've just taken care of that. I've replaced this misconception. And the research is clear. Replacement is not really what happens. Often what we have to do is we have to let that misconception remain there and then just start showing in multiple ways what is the failure of that. And over time, they'll slowly assimilate this new knowledge. And maybe at some point they'll say, oh, I remember I used to think this way, but now I know for these key pieces. So this misconceptions research really, I think, revolutionized the idea of discourse and why it's so important to have students speaking in class. If you recall, I think I mentioned this before, that, when I was a young lad, a teacher was judged on how quiet can you keep your class? That was it. It was discipline. And so, having teachers allowing students to speak, because we now realized they had brains and they had thoughts. I mean, this was revolutionary. And so that How People Learn guide really said, if you want to know what students are thinking, you better ask them. So I think that was a key point to that misconceptions research. And then remember, we were also coming out of this constructivism, and that was, maybe it was around there, but one of the things that we went too far is we were like, look, students have to construct everything on their own. And you had mentioned expertise, and this document does a really nice job of summarizing what is it that experts do. Well, let's be clear. You still need facts, and there are certain things you just need to know. Experts have those on tap. They can pull them at any time. So they have a vast array of facts that they can use. So when we're talking about make sure you're pushing inquiry and make sure you're not just lecturing, students still need that. I mean, they're going to need something to have a basis for. It's just it shouldn't be completely dominated, like 100%. So work right towards that. But once we recognize that, experts have facts, they can pull those out, and then they can connect them in ways that others can't. And I think that was one of the really important pieces. Now, you had asked earlier on what's held up and what hasn't. At the time, they were really pushing making conceptual models and like flow charts and things of that nature. I don't think that really has stuck around since this research, but I remember there was a big push for that. I think it's a pretty good idea, but I don't know if you physically need to write that stuff down. I think we do that in our right minds all the time. But those are the first couple that you mentioned. And then metacognitive strategies they mentioned. And this is crucial. We have to make sure that students understand about their own thinking. I mean, no one's better. It's like going to the doctor. And, you're like, doc, tell me what's wrong with me, And they're like, well, tell me a little bit. And you're like, look, I'm paying you. You tell me. No. Often we know what's wrong. Look, I think my ear is the problem, because I keep sneezing and it hurts there. The more we get in touch with how we feel about our body, we're often better able to communicate and let the doctor do what they need to do. So helping students understand that you need to be thinking about your thinking, and the research is clear, and they document a few cases of this, why it's so important for students to be thinking about their own thinking. That is that metacognitive piece.
And can I jump in here real quick just to ask, like, so in our quick quizzes, for example, you have students, we always ask whoever's using this quick quiz to rate their confidence. Would you consider this just thinking about, is this a small type of metacognition?
Yeah.
And then, so maybe that's like an easy way that teachers could, you know, dip their toe in the water for getting their students to think a bit about their thinking. But what are some other ways that a younger teacher, let's say that they're accustomed to just giving some AP style problem sets out for a homework assignment, you know, what are some ways that they could start to work in either through assignments or through actual classroom, you know, sessions? How can they work in some of the metacognition?
Well, let's go through all three. Let's go through the other. We got calculus, we've got physics, biology, and chemistry. So let's say that you have a biology question, you know, and as this document is talking about, go to the big idea. So if you're talking about, like, let's look at the Harvey Weinberg model for prey and population and things of that nature, it doesn't matter what you're thinking about. Where do you start? Well, one of the things is you can tell an expert versus a novice if they're like, well, I remember this one fact. Okay, well, a fact versus saying, well, according to Darwinian evolution, we would, you know, so, you know, just saying that out loud, another student saying, you know what, that also ties to this other piece. So I think discourse is the key. And whenever you have student to student discourse, now you have to be metacognitive, because you're asking students, this is the practice that we're trying to get in the classroom. It's not just about talking, it's about talking and about trying to make claims, and they might be small claims, and then trying to back that up, and then listening to others and saying, I've listened to you carefully, I have a counter argument to this that I'm going to try and back up. That certainly is going to help align everything. And by the way, this is what scientists do, right? So this is just healthy. This is the kind of discourse. Imagine if we had this in the political system, right? Where you said, I appreciate, that's a very nice scheme that happens to work, you know, and differentiate these things. So with quick quizzes, so that was a biology example. Chemistry, you should always be talking about, look, are we talking about quantum? Are we talking about standard or classical atomic theory?
I suppose just to for my own sake, so I can understand how you know I can help students do this. One way we mentioned was having them assess their confidence. So they have to think back through their way, their answer, and actually stand behind it and say, well, why am I confident in this? And how confident should I be? It makes them assess how committed they are to their answer. And it's an important part, because with the quick quizzes, if you just write down your answer and you don't put your confidence, you can always say, oh yeah, well, I mean, yeah, I was wrong. I didn't really think that, you know, because I just saw that it wasn't right. It forces the student to really assess that. And then in dialogue, getting students to make a claim and back their claim with some sort of evidence makes them think about their thinking in the sense that they, okay, why do I believe this?
Yeah.
And then they have to start doing that. And so are there any others that you can think of? Because I guess I'm not asking for a specific subject-to-subject metacognition, but just general practices that teachers across all disciplines could use. Well, I think these are two big ones, obviously.
One of the things that, even just on the quick quizzes, students often want to erase their first notions. No, leave that, right? Because isn't that showing that you thought deeply about, like, this idea, that was your first idea, but now as you thought about it, you've been changing how you think. So you have a record of your evolution. I mean, that's crucial to say, look, my initial gut is often, you know, going to lead me astray. As I think deeper about this and bring other things in, they're also going to think, okay, look, I've taken other quizzes like this, and I recognized that when I had these simplistic ideas and I ignored other models that I hadn't compared, I think that is metacognition at its finest.
Right.
So.
Okay. Yeah, that's very fair. And I think I actually, you know, this is something working with students that I've tutored, but also a feeling I had for myself was I felt that I would get a lot of questions in physics when I was going through it the first time. I would get them wrong based off, like, this gut feeling that I knew the answer. And it took a long time to start transitioning to not taking that first knee-jerk reaction and answering that way, but actually saying, okay, what is the underlying principle at play here? And what tool do I know I should use for this? And like that switch in thinking is, I think, getting more aligned with how experts go about thinking about problems. They say, okay, I'm dealing with, you know, figuring out, the velocity of a ball falling or something. And they say, okay, I could use energy or I could use kinematics. Right. And then you're already narrowed down to, two good options that you can then further assess. So anyway, this is just to say that like the reason I wanted to focus on the metacognitive aspect a little bit is that I don't know if there are a lot of other fields that I see this, at least not in the classes I've taken. I'm trying to think how many actually ask the students to operate in this way. So it was interesting that it was one of the seven to me, because I was just like, oh, I didn't know that that was such a foundational thing, but it's cool that the cognition research actually supports that. Anyway, I digress and you can continue with those.
Think about social workers. Don't they ask, you know, someone who's done something wrong, tell me what you were thinking when you did this?
Sure.
I mean, it makes you really, and by verbalizing it, I mean, right away, you almost don't need the social worker there. You can watch, you know, as they go through and they start to say, you know, now I think about it, if that happened to someone in my family, you know, I would feel this way. I mean, it's transformative. So the social sciences often get a bad rap, and we desperately need them in the hard sciences so that we can get better at learning. Let's quickly go through this last piece. This learning is situated. And we're going to have to spend an entire podcast just on situated learning. Most teachers don't understand this. If you say it's situative, they're like, I don't even know what that means. But there's some real fine points. One of the big things that we have to talk about is transfer. So in other words, this is the great problem. How do I learn something in one context and then have it transfer to another? Because if it can't, well, then it's just isolated. And if we're saying that situated learning is we're learning in an environment, a time, a space with certain senses, and if I don't have those over there, why would that be helpful to me? So they skirt around this massive issue and they simply say, make sure that you're using several contexts. Don't just teach a problem one way. Use it in a multiple or plethora of different ways, and that's going to essentially give you a much greater chance of being able to transfer. But that's a difficult one, and that's always been a criticism of situated learning. And for a while there, I mean, I remember, you know, it's funny when you look at these books and you see the authors are for the situative piece, you know, Jim Greeno and Lauren Resnick, you know, I used to have a class with them. So you can hear them in your mind or whatever. And you remember asking and hearing them debate about these ideas. And it's just a fascinating field. But for our teachers, what you need to know is that context matters. So think about if all you're ever doing is a blackboard, you speaking at the students, right? Think about what that context is. Think about the, you know, how is that going to help students in the future? And I think just knowing that that exists is a rather important piece.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, to sort of circle back to what we hope some teachers might do, first off, we hope that we've given a summary that is somewhat actionable, and there's some takeaways and at least things that maybe teachers can take a deeper dive on. But I think the biggest takeaway for me was that the first 14 or 16 whatever pages, if you just read that, the executive summary of this report, and maybe skimmed some of the other sections, you would be coming away with, you know, 80% of what I think most teachers would really benefit from having from this book. And it's really accessible. It looks like it's really long because, like, you know, when I opened up the PDF, it was 600 pages. I mean, you can get it for free on NRC's website. But there's a lot of like detailed case reports at the end from interviews and stuff. And so I don't think everyone needs to read those. But the whole document itself is 200 pages. But if you just read the first 15 pages, whatever the executive summary is, I think that would be a really good start. And a lot of these pieces, as you've said time and time again, are still relevant. So maybe to close, just because I know we always end up talking longer than we expect to. Maybe you could just speak a little bit to what you've seen since the time you first read this, If things are pretty much the same, and if we're, you know, if we're making any progress along these routes, and sort of what you would hope teachers take away from this one.
Before I do that, I just want to point out that if there's another chapter to read, chapter 11, recommendations, it goes, it goes through explicitly, you know, about what we are talking
about. Yeah, so that's at the end of the executive summary as well, just in less depth. So I would agree, though, if you read the executive summary and you read chapter 11 with recommendations, you have a really good jumping off point for ways you can improve your course. And say, like I was thinking about how I would actually use some of this. And if I'm going to go and teach in a math department, I am going to want to assess, like, am I doing, just take this checklist of seven things, and have I set, you know, the course up to take it, these things into account. As a bare minimum, doing a checklist like that, I think could help me, you know, ensure that I'm trying to align with what we know about student learning. And so,
I want to point out for administrators, they should read these recommendations. It says, in no uncertain terms, eliminate courses with low expectations. It also tells them, this is directly for teachers, while students just believing in themselves doesn't, it has some effect, teachers believing that students can learn is crucial. And when we put students and we track them into these classes, well, they're not going to learn it anyhow. What do you think's going to happen? Anyhow, your first question that I've already forgotten, can you repeat what you wanted me to do? Oh, the difference in how it's been enacted up to this point.
Yeah, because you said the first time you read it was in 2007. I know that you pointed this book out to me in 2014 when I was in your course at Freedom. And I know I skimmed parts of it. And then now, you know, we're what's crazy is we're another decade on from that.
Yeah.
And so I'm just curious, from the time you first read it through your PhD through to today, what are some of the things that you've learned through your experience teaching? And what could you sort of say to teachers out there that want to, you know, use this information to enhance their classrooms?
First thing that I would say is all of the documents that we are going over, some of them are decades old, and you might think, oh, these are outdated. They're not. The terminology might have changed. I still use the word inquiry. We now are using science and engineering practices, cross-cutting concepts, but in general, they're very, very similar. There's little tweaks here or there. So, look, we've been doing this for decades, and the research has been showing us what to do. We're still not using, and I'll use the term experimentalism, very much in our courses. They are telling us, please, and they've got a beautiful list of what not to do in class, please stop doing cookbook labs, right? They tell us students should be in charge. Students should have an opportunity to be able to design the lab, to decide what quantitative and qualitative features are going to be good enough, whatever that means, and they should be defining that. I still don't see that. I see that we now, instead of using textbooks, we have PowerPoint presentations, we now have videos, we've got all of these electronic pieces, which
FET simulations and other, you know, these sorts of things that are touted as really great learning tools, but I still think miss a lot of, you know, the experimental aspects you're talking about.
And this is where this book is a little dated, because remember, 2002, we didn't have...
Right, they're like, please use the internet and other tools, you know, it's like... I'm sure there's a lot of work that has been done in the meantime, but it's important to point out what you're saying, which is that you can change what it looks like. It might not look like a textbook anymore, but if you're, at the end of the day, if you're speaking at your students with slides or simulations or whatever else, and they're not actively engaged and not active... you know, if they're not acting as scientists in the classroom, then you're missing the mark for sure.
I want to point out one of my favorite things here. It is a little dated in terms of the technology, but they were talking about you could take AP, an AP class, AP Physics. They pointed out and they said, look, you could take it online, and never have to have even a single laboratory experience at that time. I think they've moved away from that. I don't know. But we look, it's the same old, we'll repackage and we'll act like we're doing something. But, one of the things that I would encourage teachers is try not to get too hung up on the vocabulary of your era or of that time and just think, am I doing, and am I helping my students work as scientists, as mathematicians? I think if you start to think of that, so what do they do? And maybe the word's going to be a little bit different. Maybe that we don't use that. By the way, scientists use computers all the time. So technology is not bad, but you have to use it the right way. The simulations, they're not bad. Make sure that you're helping your students. Teachers are still needed to say, here are the important aspects. Even though we're using the simulation and maybe we don't have a physical model here, can you now explain what's happening using kinetic molecular theory or whatever it might happen to be? Force them to go to those bigger ideas and then try to back that. But I do see an awful lot of polishing. I see a lot of chrome, and they've been saying, well, it's basically the same thing. We're still not meeting the mark. I hope we're doing better. I know one of the things that they had said with AP is, if you're going to be an AP teacher, you need preparation, you need time, you need training. I think they have done that for AP teachers, but there is the planned curriculum and then there's the enacted curriculum. And let's face it, if you're teaching AP, you feel real pressure to get those students to pass the test. At the end here, they are essentially saying, find different ways than AP. Most of your colleges would only accept a 4 or a 5. Most students do not get these. And even if they did, most of them, they are recommending. And almost every college professor I've ever met is, retake that introductory level at university. So I just don't see the benefit of trying to, to do something that really no one wants. But remember, administrators and parents feel that if we have AP, I mean, you'll hear administrators, you'll hear school boards say, look, if you have AP, you've got a great program. And it's like, superficially, it sounds good and it sounds like you have advanced study. But what this is saying is advanced study should not only be for those few students, it should be for all students. And if you do it according to reform pedagogy, everyone wins. And by the way, if you're an administrator listening to this, if you're a school board and you're worried about your overall scores, if you focus on all students achieving at high level, your scores aren't pulled up just a minute amount by your high flyers. Everyone elevates and your overall scores are going to be greater. So it's a win-win.
Right. Well, as per usual, we could continue going on, but I think we should probably end it here with these takeaways. And, you know, if anyone is listening and has questions, we would be all ears. Either a comment on YouTube or an email would be very welcome on any of these topics. It would be great to hear from some teachers that do teach AP and hear what they have to say about their experience. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Idealized Science Podcast. If you want to hear more, you can find the podcast on YouTube, you can find it on Spotify, and pretty much anywhere you listen to podcasts. If you're interested in more of our offerings for teachers and students, please check out our website at www.idealizedscience.org. We have links there to all of our social media and everything else where you can connect with us, ask questions, and access our free content. And if you are wanting to support our mission here of bringing high quality physics and science education to high schools all across America, you can always donate also at idealizedscience.org, and we would greatly appreciate that. So thank you again for watching, and we hope to see you in the next episode.
Always enjoyable. We'll talk to you next time.